Bloomberg Surveillance with Michael McKee and Tom Keane. On demand via our Bloomberg Radio Plus app. Free for iPhone and Android devices.
Matthew Winkler, the Bloomberg Editor-in-Chief Emeritus, interviewing Bill Dudley. The Q&A following the speech.
Are the data on corporate debt a healthy sign for the economy as a whole? And are companies helping to support the expansion?
I would say that the corporate sector fundamentals are exceptionally good. You look at corporate profit margins, basically at an all-time high. You look at corporate liquidity, cash flow, everything. You look at financing costs. So plenty of liquidity available at very low cost. Cash flow is very strong, all positive. The real conundrum is the fact that business fixed investment hasn't actually been stronger. I mean, if you ask me, I've been a little bit surprised that the fundamentals are not leading to more strength in business fixed investment. Now, that may be about to change because as the economy moves to higher rates of resource utilization, more pressure on resources, you'll start to see business fixed investment start to show through. So I think some pickup in the pace for business fixed investment, ex oil and gas, I think is something that we can look forward to over the months ahead.
And we're now approaching the seventh year of an expansion. And you said at the outset of your talk this morning, inflation's still too low, unemployment's still too high. Can you think of any time in recent memory where we've been 7 years into an expansion and inflation's too low, unemployment's too high, and debt ratios are as good as this?
Well, I think it's what you'd expect coming out of a financial crisis, that there's a long period of balance sheet adjustment. And I think the one big positive for the U.S. is that balance sheet adjustment has taken place, both in the household and the business sector. The expansion doesn't know how old it is. So the fact that it's 6 years old and counting doesn't, in my mind, in any way imply that it's sort of in its middle to old age. I think we could grow for many years farther.
Let's take another look at where corporate America is, and especially from the perspective of mergers and acquisitions. And this chart shows you the amount of money that has been committed to buy other companies, $1.66 trillion on M&A in 2014, busiest year in the past 12 years, and the number of deals is the highest as well. How do you explain this big increase in mergers and acquisitions? And again, does it help the economy grow?
Well, I think the pickup in merger and acquisitions, again, is a reflection of improvement in business confidence. It's also a sign of how still pretty vibrant the economy is. People make these acquisitions in part because they're trying to implement changes in their business strategy, and that's in consequence of the fact that the global economy is changing on an ongoing basis. So I think the fact that you're seeing this merger and acquisition activity is another sign of improved business confidence.
The last slide I want to show you is about the American consumer. And there's been a lot of anxiety about where is the American consumer at this point in the expansion. Some economists have actually suggested that it's been a mediocre performance. When we look at the data here, what we see is that sales per share for consumer discretionary companies in the S&P 500 reached the highest since we started compiling this data in 1990, and that the sales relative to those for consumer staple companies, those discretionary versus staples, is also the highest since June 2008, to be precise. So do these charts showing greater sales for discretionary goods and services rising, do these charts give you confidence the consumer demand is going to be what it should be?
I think it reflects in part the fact that the drop in oil and gas prices has basically boosted real incomes. And in the short run, when people are surprised that they have a little bit more money in their pocket, you would expect that to actually go into discretionary purchases. And so I think this is a consequence of the decline in gasoline prices that we've seen over the last 6 months. When you look at the household sector, the positives are mostly favorable. We've had pretty strong employment trends over the last year. In fact, last year was the strongest employment growth year since 1999. We're starting to see the beginnings of an uptick in wage pressures. I mean, wages are actually rising too slow relative to our 2% inflation objective. We're starting to see an acceleration there. And so if you look at the broad consumer confidence indices, they're either at or very close to their highs. So I think the outlook for consumption is pretty positive.
So the consumer has plenty of room to run.
I think the consumer has plenty of room to run. I mean, as I said in my prepared remarks, the savings rate is actually a little high relative to what one would expect given the big improvements we've seen in net worth relative to income. Households have deleveraged tremendously since the beginning of the financial crisis. So we actually are looking for consumer spending to definitely pick up as we look forward into the next few quarters.
Fed officials have been saying they're going to move away from a measured pace of tightening to a less predictable one. And if you do that, how will you avoid a repeat of, and you mentioned it this morning, the 1994 tightening cycle that caused so much confusion?
Well, I think that what's different now compared to 1994 is that I think we're a lot clearer on what we're going to do, why we're going to do it, and what are the things that are going to drive those decisions. Now, we can't be quite as clear as people would want in specifying a time and a quantity because the economy itself is uncertain. But we can certainly describe to people how we're going to think about things. And so as the economic news evolves, we would hope that market participants, households and businesses would be able to sort of think along with us. I'll be very surprised that whenever normalization occurs, that'll be a big surprise to anyone if we're doing our job properly.
So interest rates aren't on a predetermined path, yet the Fed said the same thing about tapering QE, and it turned out to be very predictable. Why should investors expect anything different this time?
Well, I don't think we know if it's going to be predictable or unpredictable because that really depends on the two things that I highlighted in my remarks. One, how does the economy perform? If the economy performs in a very regular, predictable way, then the interest rate path could be more regular and predictable. Similarly, financial markets. If financial markets react to our policy moves in a regular, predictable way, then that would reinforce that. But I suspect we'll have surprises both in terms of the economy and we'll have surprises in terms of how financial markets react. So I very much would be quite surprised if the 2004-2007 monotonic rate increases from 1% to 5.25% were replicated in the future. That would be a surprise to me.
Do you have any kind of working list of positive and negative surprises that you're prepared for?
I think about the possible. Well, if there are surprises, I obviously wouldn't be prepared for them. So we try to think about what could surprise us all the time, and we do contingency planning against those. But what we would see is low risk events that could actually materialize. There's a lot of things that we just don't know what's going to happen over the months and years ahead. I mean, obviously for right now, there's a lot of speculation about what's going to happen in Europe with respect to Greece. There's speculation about what that would mean for the Eurozone and the global economy. So that's one wild card. Another wild card is what's the consequences of the strength in the dollar for U.S. export performance and U.S. imports and how big a drag will that be on U.S. trade and how will that filter into the U.S. economy? It's another question. Oil and gas investment. We've never had a big boom in oil and gas production like this in the last few decades, and now we've seen a very big drop in oil prices internationally. So how will this actually weigh on U.S. Oil and gas investment? How fast will this play out? And what will be the future trajectory of oil and gas prices is very, very uncertain. So there's definitely a lot of wild cards in the outlook.
One of the biggest surprises, if I can call it that, coming out of the financial crisis is that so many people who initially believed that QE might be inflationary, overly stimulative, and yet as we've seen over the past 5 years, it's been anything but. Inflation has been, as you said, underwhelming, continues to be. And yet you've also said you have a tremendous amount of uncertainty about how markets react to a rate increase. How do you view the risk of, wave of capital inflows driving the dollar even higher? Could that make it harder to achieve your policy goals?
Well, obviously, if bond markets move, stock markets move, currencies move, that's going to affect the whole panoply of what financial conditions look like. And you know, as I implied by remarks, if financial conditions were to tighten a lot, then that would probably slow us down, or could even delay us. So that will certainly be a factor in terms of what we do.
Labor market right now looks very strong. Unemployment is now 5.5%. Yet the headline rate doesn't count discouraged workers who stopped looking for work and account for some of the recent decline in the participation rate. The labor participation rate is less than what it was before the financial crisis. How much hidden slack is there?
Well, we don't know for sure, but you're absolutely right. I think the 5.5% unemployment rate overstates the degree of tightness in the U.S. labor market. If you look at other measures of the unemployment rate, like the so-called U6, you know, people who are working part-time for economic reasons, or if you look at the participation rate, it looks like the declines in the participation rate imply that some people may have dropped out of the labor force because they become discouraged. As the labor market improves, you'd expect some of those discouraged workers to come back into the labor force. The tough part is we can't really tell how much of that decline in the participation rate reflects those type of people versus those who have just left the labor force for good. So, yes, I think that's right. I mean, the unemployment rate probably overstates the degree of tightness. One thing that will be very, very important to watch is the performance of wages, because the wages is really a good measure of what the degree of tightness in the labor market. If the unemployment rate were to decline but wages were to stay very subdued, that would cause you to tend to think that there was more slack in the labor market, either because the unemployment rate mismeasured the overall slack in the labor market or because the full employment rate was lower than you thought. I mean, one reason to think that maybe there's also a little bit more slack in the U.S. economy is the demographics of the labor force. The population of the U.S. has aged. And as a consequence, one might think that the full employment rate is actually a little bit lower as a consequence. If you did like NARUS by age cohort, you'd find that the age cohort for the older workers would be somewhat lower. We did a little bit. I looked at this not too long ago, and if you had the same age distribution of the population today that you had in 1982, the NARU on a comparable basis today would be about 1 percentage point lower. So the changing composition of the labor force is also important.
My colleague Shinpei and I looked at some data recently that showed so far in the 21st century, those ages between 25 and 34 have a higher rate of unemployment than the overall unemployment rate. Do you have any idea what's going on here?
I think first of all, when you're coming out of a severe recession and a financial crisis, it's not the greatest time to get your first job after school. I actually remember this very well because I went on the job market in 1974, which was also the eve of a very deep recession, and half the jobs I was overqualified for and half the jobs I was underqualified for. So it actually took me a while to find my first job. Once you find that first job, though, then it's usually pretty easy to start making your way up the ladder. So it's really getting to that first rung on the ladder that's difficult, and I think that's been difficult over the last few years. I think we're mostly past that now. In other words, I think the unemployment rate is low enough, the labor market is tight enough, that the tough job environment for graduates is going to start to ease.
So we're going to revert to the 20th century mean?
I don't know. We'll see.
That is said, it must be reasonably confident. Those are the two words used, that inflation will move back up toward the goal before raising interest rates. You, I think, are saying you are reasonably confident today that we will get there.
I think I will become reasonably confident in the future. In other words, if the forecast that I've outlined actually materializes, then I think I would be reasonably confident. But I'm not reasonably confident quite right now.
When we, and you referenced this also this morning, turn to banks you supervise. You've been in the hot seat lately over allegations the bank examiners are susceptible to so-called regulatory capture. What steps are you taking to deal with this issue and you know, resolve it?
Well, we've taken many, many steps in terms of how we do supervision at the New York Federal Reserve and a part of the Federal Reserve System. We have to remember that supervision is actually run by the Board of Governors in Washington. We're sort of their agents. They're in charge of supervision. There's been a number of changes. The one big change is how we look at systemically important financial institutions. We look at them as a portfolio, and we examine them relative to one another. And so that's I think, a very, very important guardrail. Second thing we do, you know, in New York is we rotate people. So people don't sit as an examiner for a firm for very long before they get moved to another firm, so they don't get too comfortable. Another thing that we're just implementing right now very recently is we're actually pulling people out of the firms and bringing them back to home base, so they spend a lot less time at the firms and a lot more time talking to one another at the home office in New York. So this is something that we've made a lot of changes to try to make supervision more effective, both at the New York Fed and in Washington. And I think that the proof of the pudding is, let's take a look at the health of the banking system today. I think it's in a much better shape today than it was, 5 to 10 years ago. Regulatory policy changes too, in which I participated, higher capital requirements, higher liquidity requirements. I mean, I think that end of the day, the proof of the pudding is, are the banks in much better shape today to withstand a significant financial shock than they were back in 2007, 2008? And I think the answer is absolutely. I don't think anyone would dispute that.
We recently looked at the biggest banks in Canada as a group, and did the same with the U.S., so it's an apples-to-apples comparison. And what's interesting about the data is that by any measure, the Canadian banks are healthier than U.S. banks. So what can we do to improve? What should we do to improve?
Well, I think the U.S. banking market, I think, is quite different than the Canadian market. I'll leave it to my colleague to discuss further later on in the program, mainly because our banking sector is less concentrated, and there's a lot of competition. I think there's probably even greater competition from the rest of the financial system. In other words, if you look at the U.S. economy, not that much credit actually gets intermediated through the banking system. A whole bunch of credit gets intermediated through the capital markets, so that makes it a more competitive system. I think the Canadian banks have done a great job going through the crisis and weathering the crisis and coming out the other side. And this is something that we definitely want to emulate here in the U.S., and I think that's one of the reasons why we've been very tough-minded about forcing the banks to hold more capital and liquidity. And so, hard to say where we are on a relative basis, but I think on an absolute basis, banking systems in both countries are in very good shape.
GE is selling its financial operations, and it's going to end its systemically important designation. Would you like to see big banks shrink or sell units to get smaller, so they won't be systemically important?
I'd like to see big banks get less complex. I'd like to see big banks have more capital and liquidity. I'd like to see big banks better managed. I'd like to see big banks have better ethics and culture. Whether they have to downsize, I think that's a business decision based on the environment that they seek. But I don't think in any way we should roll back any of the regulatory regimes that we put in place. I don't think we should dial back any of the pressure that we put on these banks to behave better. And if they feel that this pressure is sort of too great and they decide that they want to have simpler banking organizations, smaller banking organizations, I think that'd be fine. I'd be perfectly content with that.
Members of Congress are considering measures to increase oversight of the Fed and to make it more transparent. You talked a lot about transparency this morning. You and other officials have said the Fed is plenty transparent already and made probably more changes in the past 5 years, 6 years than it's probably made any time. Yet your arguments don't seem to be getting through to everybody. So what more do you think you need to do to assuage these members of Congress who are, after all, maybe your bosses?
Well, I mean, the Federal Reserve is a creature of Congress, for sure, and so they set the rules, and we need to abide by those. That said, though, proposals like audit the Fed, I think, are very, very misplaced. First of all, the Fed is audited, so the idea that you'd somehow need an audit when the audits are already ongoing seems to be not right. The second thing, I think, is that if you look at the audit the Fed bill, basically what it would do is it would allow the GAO to essentially evaluate monetary policy decisions on an ongoing basis. So every monetary policy decision that was made, the GAO could evaluate. And I think that would be very unfortunate, because I think that would politicize monetary policy making. We've really found, I think, not just in the U.S. but throughout the world, that central banks generate better outcomes when monetary policy is at least a little bit insulated from the political process. And I think that an audit of the Fed bill that would make every policy decision sort of up for grabs politically, I think that would not be a good thing, because one, it would put some pressure on the Fed politically. I think we would resist that pressure. But two, even if we were able to resist that pressure, financial markets would put financial markets on edge, that somehow the Fed could be compromised in the future, and that would lead to higher risk premium on financial assets. So I think it's sort of a lose-lose in terms of it would drive up the cost of credit for everybody in the economy. I think it would be a bad decision.
And if we're lucky enough, all of us, to convene here a year from now, do you think the Fed will be the same?
I don't know. I mean, it's really for Congress to decide. I think that, I think on audit the Fed, I would hope that cooler heads will prevail and ask the question: is the Fed providing all the information that people need to have to evaluate the Fed's decision making? I think we are. I think we give. For example, there's a question about the Fed's balance sheet. What are these securities that the Fed holds on our balance sheet, as if there's some great mystery? We publish every last CUSIP number. Just dig a little bit, you'll find that all the information that you need. And when I go down to talk to people in the Capitol, I sort of ask them a very simple question: what is it that you're not getting that you want to get from us? And I'm happy to have that conversation, because I really do think that they're pretty much getting everything that they want and need.
And the answer is, when you ask?
I haven't really heard anything that compelling in terms of what they're not getting that they need.
I know we're out of time, and I just want to thank you again for your gems of insight, perspective, Mr. President. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Matt.
Bloomberg Surveillance, weekday mornings at 7 Eastern. In New York on Bloomberg 1130. In Boston on 1200 AM and 94.5 FM HD2. Or on Sirius XM Satellite Radio, channel 119.